Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along this morning, and thanks to Cause Chambers Wethgut for the use of this facility, and also for the generosity and catering for us today. We're here on the occasion of the launch of Anne Henderson's Mary McKillop Sisters, A Life Unveiled, the new edition, which has some new material. And we're very grateful that Tim Fisher, who happens to be in Australia, could make it here today. So I'll introduce Tim Fisher, who's going to lead off first. Tim Fisher, the Honourable Tim Fisher AC, is the former leader of the Nationals, the former Deputy Prime Minister, and currently Australia's ambassador to the Holy See, who's been very much involved in the canonisation process for Mary McKillop. And Tim Fisher's going to lead off talking on the topic, Mary McKillop, A View from Rome. And then Anne's going to talk briefly about her book. We'll take a couple of questions and a few points of discussion, and we'll finish probably about 11:45. So we lead off with the ambassador. Many thanks.
Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Gerard Henderson. Dr. Anne Henderson, congratulations. And buongiorno, let's clear it up. Buongiorno is the correct address here today. Come stai? Come sta? Tutto bene, Ale? And good to see so many good friends here today, including Nick as chair of the Sydney Institute. And I commend the contribution the Sydney Institute has made to the well-being of Sydney for its recent anniversary. A much-needed one for helping to ensure Australia is not an insular part of the world, but indeed engaged with many debates within and without. And again today, in this setting here at Cause Chambers Westgarth, appreciate that. Many delighted to see some good friends and colleagues, and former colleagues from boards and parliaments, including Peter Coleman and Clive Powell and so many others, Jim Demix, and wish you all well. As I turn to the subject at hand, Mary McKillop's Sisters, A Life Unveiled. This is an awesome unity ticket you are witnessing here this morning, because the book was actually launched by one Paul Keating, former Prime Minister of Australia. The book is being relaunched by one Tim Fisher, former Deputy Prime Minister of Australia, from the opposite side of politics variously, but now in this apolitical role of Australian Ambassador to the Holy See, and I have a zero comment on certain domestic matters unfolding as we speak, and DFAT has sworn me to this approach. I stand by that approach, but happily get on with the job of my midterm leave and consultations, the penultimate day of those. Great honour to be asked to launch this. With regard to the canonisation, before I turn to the book specifically, some 8,000 are now heading to Rome. Last year, 2009, 400 Australian replacement passports had to be issued in Rome quite quickly, in a matter of a couple of hours, to help ease the burden. We assess about half of those, DFAT assessors, were lost or stolen, and the target zones are around Termini, and the trains to and from airport, most notably. Professional gangs, you're not going to get stabbed or anything, but you are going to get bumped. The little old lady's going to fall over in front of you. The second member of the team will, in a split second, have your purse or your wallet or your passport, and this is very upsetting and derailing. DFAT will be putting extra resources into consular backup for the visit of some 8,000 Australians to St Peter's Square on the 17th of October to the canonisation of Mary McKillop. And both David Ritchie in the other embassy, Amanda Vanstone having come back to Australia, David Ritchie having taken up that posting 2 months ago, and myself will be working absolutely, we're under instruction to work absolutely close together and make sure there's a maximum help to the thousands of Australians coming, maximum joy as well as we celebrate. And I'm delighted to confirm that the 100 dozen of donated Coonawarra wines of excellence past the Somalian pirates, through the Suez Canal, are en route for the week of activities and celebrations of the 15th, 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th and 18th October, which we'll be helping out with the Sisters of St. Joseph and the church, although of course all detailed matters relating to the canonisation of course are matters for the SOSJ and the Vatican. One Vatican flag, silk version, has been delivered to Panola. I was happy to present that about 3 weeks ago. They needed cheering up after a mini tornado had hit Panola. I think that was a good bargain. They get this one beautiful Vatican flag, and 100 dozen of the best is now arriving in Rome. And it'll be a good chance to showcase excellent Australian product. Why Panola? Well, let's turn to Mary McKillop. Born Melbourne, that ticks the state colony Victoria. Sacked unfairly as a schoolteacher Portland, she bounced back. On to Panola, opened her first school in South Australia, 1866, established such a fantastic template that it kicked on and began to establish the Sisters of St. Joseph, so well developed in the book Mary McKillop's Sisters. Excommunicated Adelaide, recommunicated Adelaide, so she went to South Australia. Died over here, North Sydney, New South Wales. Worked all the way up to Townsville and back, Queensland. Went to Albany at age 31 on a ship sailing through Colombo to Italy. Landed at Brindisi and then caught a train, very proud of her, 18-hour train service at the time, from Brindisi to Rome. Saw the Pope twice. The Pope ruled in her favour against some bishops of the era, and the Sisters of St. Joseph have gone on from strength to strength since that time. So we do look forward to welcoming many of you in Rome at the time, welcoming His Eminence Cardinal Pell, Archbishop Philip Wilson, Sister Anne Derwin of the Sisters of St. Joseph, and about 130 sisters. I'm practicing cooking some lamingtons for their morning tea I'm hosting in their honour. But this, a little bit of breaking news, I haven't referred to one other state, the colony of Tasmania. Following some confirmation down there on Monday with Father Michael Tate and Archbishop Doyle, I'm very pleased to confirm for the first time that on the 18th of October 1897, Mary McKillop made a one-day visit to Hobart whilst on a ship back from New Zealand, paid 4 shillings for a taxi down to Lower Sandy Bay to see a sister in a convent there, 1 shilling for a tram ride back. There were trams in Hobart at the time, and we're now able to say that this was one quintessential Australian of renown who, in fact, against the odds, physically, went to every state and colony as they existed at that time as colonies of our great country, Australia. 4 trips to New Zealand, 3 trips to Ireland from Rome, 2 to Scotland, 1 to London, and often running out of money and having to beg her passage along the way. A brave lady, a devoted lady, a devout lady, a dedicated lady. But today's focus is on the sisters that then took up the cudgels. This book I'm relaunching, Mary McKillop's Sisters, A Life Unveiled, and Henderson, introduction by Edmund Campion, and launching speech I commend by former Prime Minister Keating. When you do this all over again, you'll then have the relaunching speech after Paul Keating's in a couple of years' time. I would want to say that this is an excellent snapshot, but of necessity, as the lengthy book it is, as the sisters that are covered in here, in its packed pages, 300 pages, it is, of course, a snapshot that goes back to the records and the archives and the oral interpretations and the memories of so many people. Let me just highlight one. Sister Sheila McCraner, who's coming to Rome, is very active with the SOSJ, and I've met with a number of times. Born in Barmera, South Australia, entered the SOSJ quite 1968, age 17. Taught in South Australia and then studied elsewhere and then ultimately ended up coordinating a master's thesis on refugee students in Catholic schools because of her work in various suburbs of Adelaide and Sydney. And she travelled to Laos, Vietnam and Cambodia and worked, in fact, through those Laotian refugee camps so that she could better understand why they were so scared, why the children had to be sort of unlocked and resume educational activity when she was back here in Australia. And of course, she's over in North Sydney and on way to Rome again now. I want to make one point. These are hands-on sisters. They don't just hide away in a library of a monastery or a convent, or hide away in the various cocoons that can come to exist in the oldest organisation in the world. They are out there. They are engaged. Indeed, Sister Mary MacKillop urged the sisters to go out and vote in a very direct letter at the particular time of an election leading up to the Federation of Australia. And there's Sheila McCrana, Sister Sheila McCrana, near Arunyaprathet on the border between Thailand and Laos. I just want to paint a scene for 1 minute here. Been to those refugee camps. Watched the immigration officers interviewing a young family. I can still see in my mind. Husband in nice clean coloured t-shirt. Wife in their 30s. Two kids, probably 7 or 8. And on every utterance and response to this 40-minute interview swung their life. Because it was either a dream ticket out to Australia, or it was back into the camps and perhaps subsequent selection. The problem is those camps were being raided. Some of the kids were being dragged back into Cambodia, back into Laos, and back into slave gangs and into terrorist and guerrilla activity. And I'm just in awe of the fact that this Australian nun, as part of the template of the paradigm of the operation and the modus operandi established by Mary MacKillop of the SOSJ, saw Sister Sheila McCrana through the Indochina refugee camps, where lives are being decided by people under extraordinary pressure. And the greatest respect for one particular immigration officer who subsequently died in an aeroplane crash when an aeroplane ran out of fuel on approach to Bangkok, but who was putting every single effort into getting it right and doing the right thing in the job that was allocated to him at the time. Ladies and gentlemen, the last thing I want to say goes to the heart of what we're about in saluting a great Australian, not so much, or the non-believers perhaps not at all, for her spiritual activity. I mean, she's done many miracles. The latest is this morning. I had breakfast with Sir Lawrence Street, whose nickname, of course, is Lorenzo the Magnificent. I said, hang on a tick. I went and saw your tomb in Florence a month ago with a senator. And went to the Medici Chapels, and there was the tomb. Lorenzo the Magnificent. And you're back alive again. And I was very happy to shake hands with the extra miracle by MacKillop in recreating, resurrecting Sir Lawrence Street. In very good form he was this morning, I must hasten to add. But I know Senator Maurice Payne, I notice is here, and others have reflected on the fact that there is much awesome Australia can be proud of. 3.3% economic growth figures overnight, one thing. But an underclass, yes, it does exist out there in the western suburbs and many other places. Poverty, yes, it does exist. But I tell you what, it's smaller in quantum and smaller in per capita than the United States of America, the largest economy in the world, by a country mile. Why is that so? Well, to cut right through, the one reason I choose to highlight in the context of Anne Henderson's book is because of the education that was conferred on so many people who would not have got that education but for the setting up of an adequate government school system in the state colonies, but the competition edge and the further extension of that by the early setting up of a non-government school system, including the Catholic Church school system, which Mary MacKillop spearheaded as many poor suburbs and many country areas of Australia. Penola, first one in South Australia. Numurkah, first one in Victoria. Many places in Sydney and elsewhere. In other words, that activity and that template allowed people that great high jump of opportunity. And because Australia is not as stratified as some of the countries nearby to my posting, and you don't have to go to a particular university after university to get an elite job in the public service, as you do in yet another country near where I'm currently posted. And because they had this quality foundation education conferred by the Sisters of St. Joseph, many recorded brilliantly in this book, thousands more Australians were able to perform and create a family and provide for that family and provide for the education of their children, and so further expand the dynamic of Australia in the 19th century and in the early 20th century, where the communication system did not exist as we have today and where there were many direct and indirect challenges to be faced. So I take this opportunity as an Australian first and foremost, but also Australian Ambassador to the Holy See, to salute the determination, the dedication, to salute the devotion and the contribution that the Sisters of St. Joseph and their foundation leader Mary MacKillop has made to education in Australia, directly to so many, but by its very existence and its template indirectly to so many others in government and non-government school systems. The result? We live in an awesome country. You have space. My God, every street in the cranky layout of Sydney is wider than the Via Corso through the heart of Rome, let me assure you. Every single street may be congested in Sydney, it's still wider than the Via Corso, let me tell you. But we also have opportunity, and to create and take up on that opportunity, you need education. I am delighted that this theme and this dimension emerges along with so many others, which time does not allow for me to develop, in this excellent publication, Mary MacKillop's Sisters, A Life Unveiled Under the Auspices of the Sydney Institute. I have much pleasure in declaring the book by Dr. Anne Henderson relaunched.
Now, I don't know, can you hear me? The microphone maybe should be. Hi, can you hear me? Is that on? No. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Thank you, Tim. What an ambassador for the Vatican. We've certainly got a great ambassador at the Holy See for Mary MacKillop and all that's coming in the next month or so. And everything you can deliver, Tim, including the wine. Today's quite remarkable, even the place we're in. And for the Sydney Institute to be here honouring a saint of all things, no, not Tim, an Australian saint, not Tim, but Mary. And it's quite an achievement, I think, this canonisation for what is really a very secular country, in spite of the fact that the churches have done great things here. And for many, the Sydney Institute is not a place where you find many saints. Certainly not its executive director. It's a business forum. It's a business forum in the middle of the city where ideas are discussed, ideas pertinent to the Australian debate. Even the scheduling of this event this week, where have we got Mary? We've squashed her between a talk by Fred Hilmer on microeconomic reform, which I can highly recommend, but it was a long way from sainthood, and a talk this evening by Treasurer Wayne Swan on Labor's plans for Australia's economic future. So what a contrast it is to be celebrating Mary MacKillop's sisters. But productivity assessments were very much part of Mary MacKillop's ethos. She was something of a trailblazer, something we could look back to. Most of us couldn't possibly compete with the sort of productivity that her order put in place. Imagine any business where it could be said it saved the Australian taxpayer literally billions of dollars in today's currency. And that's what they did, the Brown Josephites, as we came to know them. They set up and ran schools along with other religious orders that we now don't hear so much admiration for and should. They set up and ran schools, institutions. They took care of those children that wouldn't have probably gone to school if they hadn't been so determined to see them there. Many children, while we had a compulsory education system in Australia, didn't attend school. Their parents kept them home for all kinds of reasons. They set up institutions for the sick, the orphaned, and so on. They did what government is doing today, or supposed to be doing. And they did it for nothing more than their keep. And in many cases, they did it without their keep. They did it in convents and community houses, often with very little food, and reliant on the charity of the communities in which they worked. Now, Mary MacKillop didn't set out to save the taxpayer billions of dollars. That wasn't her cause. But in her quest to answer a call that was so strong in her to do what was she regarded as the most important thing for her life to be, that's what she did. I worked it out years ago. Billions of dollars saved. And we're here today for that, but also for much more. It was the work of the sisters that came after her and with her, the women that became the Order of Josephite Nuns, that carried her name into our own era. And we can't underestimate that. Becoming a saint, with the glorification of all that goes with the Vatican's imprint, is not done easily, as you may have gathered from some of the reading. There are many, many saints, but only a few get noticed. It was the sisters who continued the calling, built the vision, worked for her recognition, and who brought us the legacy that Australians are now about to celebrate in Mary's canonisation in Rome. The work of religious educators in Australia, an army of brothers and sisters, were all part of that, working for no salary for over a century in Catholic schools. They worked alongside the regular education, but they believed that teaching that God was part of a being's existence was most important. Mary started out in a stable, as we've just heard from the ambassador, a makeshift classroom that wouldn't have managed for animals nowadays. But she left behind 12,400 children being taught in 117 schools, supported by 109 houses, staffed by 650 Sisters of St Joseph across Australia and New Zealand. And that didn't include her refuges and orphanages. From this beginning, the order grew to be the largest and centrally governed order in Australia of religious adherents. The story of Mary MacKillop has been told and retold in volumes of history, in plays, comic books, colouring books, on cloth and tea towels, in film and documentary, and there's even a musical to come. It's a story that is linear, chronological. It's a single life of wide experience. But no less dramatic, however, are the stories of the many sisters that worked in her name. And theirs is a vast anecdote of patchwork in time, personality and experience. And how could they take the regulation and practice of one century into another, with all the change that came in 100 years? How would those who knew Mary, Mother Mary, pass on the cross, as they called it, that she bore, but also adapt to the changes around them, big changes? And then how to keep the spirit of Mary MacKillop alive in times when it was such a struggle, while at other times it was much rejoicing, success and material change, the great challenge, material advance. And to do this in ways Mother Mary could never have dreamed. But they did it. A decade ago or more, I spent a couple of years sitting down with 40 or so of the Sisters of St. Joseph, listening to their stories, some of whom I had been part of, teachers, people I knew who'd entered the order and stayed. They took me across Australia, New Zealand, Ireland. Some of them are dead now. Some of them are running the order. Nearly all left their families in their teenage years and joined a congregation that Mary MacKillop had founded. Some left Ireland at this tender age, and some of those stories are the most poignant in the book, with no full comprehension that they probably would never see their families again, and many didn't. They took vows of poverty, chastity and obedience. They lived where they were sent, in small communities and large. They gave their lives to others in ways none of us can truly understand. Their story is the story of Mary MacKillop. Their story is also the story of Australia. So I'm really thankful to HarperCollins for having sent me an email last year and saying, would I mind if I let them reprint the book? Would I mind? I said, yeah, go, do it. Yeah, why not? Because this is an account of many lives unveiled. And to Tim Fisher, Great thanks. Heartfelt thanks. What an ambassador for the sisters and all of us in Rome. And thank you all for joining us today in this life's occasion.
So thanks to the ambassador and thanks to Anne. We can take probably a couple of questions. We don't have a lot of time, but we can take a couple of questions. Tell me, Ambassador, that there's a word out that you talk occasionally to His Holiness. This is not the usual sort of role of the ambassador in Rome, I guess. What's your relationship and how did that come about?
I'm mightily relieved you actually asked that question because it allows me to correct an article in the Weekend Australian. It is not true that I speak for half an hour one-on-one with the Pope every month of the year. If it was true, every bishop between here and Rome would cut my head off on the way back on Monday via Darwin. It is true that on the presentation of credentials, as Michael Bowman and others would record, there's a process of formality and you go in and you do have a half-hour meeting with the Pope. So we presented the credentials, and then at the end of that you get the chance to present each member of your family one-off, once in a lifetime. And on your farewell call, you get 10 minutes one-on-one with the Pope. In between, a raft of meetings of as small as 10, as big as 10,000 as part of a general audience. So Grenland kept into that article last Saturday, corrected in the letters to the editor of Monday's Australian. But you do make every post a winner as you mix around and catch up with as many people as you can, including during this midterm leaving consultations.
I thought he'd become your confessor, actually. I just wonder whether half an hour once a month was enough. But obviously it is. Now, any other questions to... right down the back, yeah. Now, we're going to have questions on the book. We're not having questions on the political situation, yeah? Yeah. Well, can I respond by saying that Mary McKillop also taught school and she'd tell you to the question was out of order. Right, anything else? Yes.
Okay. I have a question.
Well,
thank you very much. I have a question to Ambassador Fisher. Of course, canonization is a purely church matter, but on the other hand, to have a saint is very prestigious for any country, and especially gives a good standing amongst the 2 billion Catholics around the world. So what role does the Australian government or the embassy in Rome had in the canonization process?
Zero with regard to the internalities of the whole process of nomination, miracles and consistory meeting in February, although I was invited as ambassador to attend that meeting in February with several other Australians, including Sister Maria Casey, and the announcement was made and clicked through for the 17th of October. But more generally, we report on key issues, interfaith dialogue, religious freedom, food security, and a raft of those issues. More generally, on the canonisation, we are liaising very closely to pull off a major reception in the Vatican Gardens on the Friday night before the canonisation and conference on Indigenous and spirituality, and bringing back up from the basement a fabulous collection collected in 1925 by Pope Pius of the time from the Kimberleys and the Tiwi Islands, no skeletal material, which is now going to be put on display in a sense paralleling the canonisation. Rome is a competitive hub, and my job is to push the profile of Australia for the 101 reasons you might do that, and it's just a happy bit of serendipity that this is occurring on my particular watch, or whoever it might have been, the ambassador, and it is to maximise everything from the Coonawarra wines of excellence to the 1925 architects of brilliance from the Tiwi tribes, which are now going to be front and centre in the Vatican Museum for a period of time associated with and after the canonisation. I'll throw to Anne because she might like to add a comment more general relating to the impact of canonisation. As I do, though, I do have to clear up one other matter. Yes, aeroplanes around this small country, you get to see people around Parliament House yesterday, you get to see people, I confess, I have met with Tony Burke, with two bishops of the female kind, Julie and Bronwyn. Just to balance it out, because we have to balance it out, bumped Barnaby Joyce by accident in the corridor near Aussies yesterday, and finally with Rob Oakeshott on leaving Parliament House to belt down to DFAT headquarters. I think I've covered both sides, and Warren Truss briefly. That's covered all bases. I leave the country still neutral.
There's a question there. We're going to take it. Yes.
Yeah. I'm a migrant to this country, and in the last few years we've heard a lot of Mother Teresa, and I do SRE at Kilara High, and I showed them a video of Mother Teresa, and then it got me thinking that sure enough we've got somebody right here, Mary McKillop. Would you like to make some comparison, either Anne or the ambassador, as to how they two rank, how they compare?
Well, I don't know whether this is working. Obviously, they both work with the poorest of the poor. And that, from my lapsed Catholic perspective, has been what the Catholic Church has certainly done and the Salvation Army have done. It's going out to those who are left behind by the institutional situation of the time. All the religious orders started up at a time when social needs were great, when governments didn't regard it as their responsibility. Mother Teresa went to Calcutta, where poverty was probably much worse than here, but believe me, out in the country districts of Australia when Mary McKillop began, little children were running around barefoot, no education, gathering them up and bringing them to school was a huge social need. And I'm doing a biography of Jo Lyons, who was a school teacher in Tasmania. In Tasmania, way back at the end of the 19th century, in spite of compulsory education, there was a huge gap between those who went to school and those who stayed home for all kinds of reasons. And often it was poverty and people who just needed their children to be with them, to mind other children or to do whatever. So these children got no education. Then, of course, there were other social needs. Mary McKillop was wonderful about prostitutes, totally the scum of society. Mary McKillop would work with them in the cities. She had these houses where she brought people in. So different in kind in one sense, different levels of affluence or whatever the societies they worked in, but both of them believed that their work was to go where others never went, to help those in the most dire need.
Just a quick word. You have to have the pleasure of reading this, but did you have an opportunity to write about the ecumenical side of the sisters, particularly out in the isolated country areas, when ecumenism wasn't ever thought about, let alone in fact. And they did a great job there. People of all denominations, especially as music teachers.
Yeah. That's the signature of Mary McKillop, right through all her schools. It wasn't where you went to church on Sunday, but what you needed done for you. And if the sisters were in a town, if that was the only place for children to be educated, you know, that was where the children went. And as the order developed, I mean, as you talk to the women that are in the book, I mean, there is nothing, not a thread of sectarianism in any of their bones. And a lot of them have wonderful relationships with Aboriginal women and Aboriginal communities. One of those pictures is one of the sisters with a little group of Aboriginal kids who are in one of the schools in Perth where she worked, and it was dysfunctional and very difficult. But another one, Annette Arnold, when I spoke to her, she'd been up in one of the big centres out of Rockhampton. But they really they believed in God, and they believed in the Catholic Church and all the rest of it, but they believed in people first of all, and bringing that, what they saw as the essence of a fully rounded future to those people. And ecumenism is right through the book because of the
book. I think it's also true, I think it's in your book, that Mary McKillop got the support of some Jews, Protestants.
Right from the very beginning. Well, that's the story of Mary McKillop. Right when she was excommunicated and when she was starting up in Adelaide, it was those who were not of the Catholic faith that were some of her strongest supporters.
Ben Collins.
Thank you. And
you've reminded everybody of the enormous contribution to schooling of Mary McKillop. I wondered if there's any evidence beyond the fact that the schools had to satisfy the school inspectors appointed here by the state. Is there any objective evidence comparing the academic, to use that word loosely, achievement reached by her schools compared to, say, other Catholic schools or with the assessments?
I can't answer that one. I don't think anyone's done it. All I know is that if you were teaching a class of 100 and, you know, 95 of them could read at the age of 7, you weren't doing a bad job. What was interesting as I went back originally when I started all this was to be staggered at how big the classes were that I actually sat in. I didn't notice it. 80 or something. I jogged a grade because there were too many in grade 6 and some of us were taken into grade 7 by one of those women that are standing up there because they just didn't have the space. This went on out at the western suburbs of Sydney. I think they had over 100 in many of the classes in the Josephite schools. Yet the education was first rate in terms of the basic arts, the three R's, reading, writing, arithmetic, whatever. I don't know that anyone's done that, and I think the problem would be at primary level you wouldn't have the statistics because it would all just be done on a local, annualised reporting, and I don't think those statistics would be left. I think the product, the proof is in the eating. I mean, how many of those people that went through these kind of schools are out there now in positions of importance and professional success all over the country? And they, you know, they know what the Josephites did and others.
Well, I think we might call it there. The ambassador has another function, and people have got to get back to work. So I just want to briefly thank Cause Chambers Westgarth again for the use of this terrific facility in the middle of the day. Thanks to Anne, who's spoken about the reissue of a book with a new introduction by Edmund Campion and a prologue by Paul Keating, which, as the ambassador says, was his original speech. And many thanks to Ambassador Tim Fisher for his talk today and for the great work he's doing in Rome, representing Australia in at the Holy See. So thanks for coming along today, and thanks to our ambassador, and to well done, Anne. So there's some copies of the book.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.